If you're driving along and you see a highway and you see one of those large center pivot irrigation systems, you should think about energy use, because it takes a lot of energy to pressurize the water to shoot it out to those very long arms on those center pivot devices.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to The Vandal Theory, a podcast about science and research at the University of Idaho. I'm Lee Cooper, your host for today. I'm a science writer and editor here at U of I, and I'm joined by my co-host, Kyle.
Hi, I'm Kyle Fonensteel. I'm media relations manager here at U of I.
Hey, Kyle. How's it going?
Good. How about you?
Oh, not too bad. Ready to jump into this one?
Yes.
All right. So today, we are going to talk about how water, irrigation, and energy use are connected in Idaho. And to kick us off with a question, nationally, where do you think Idaho ranks for the amount of water we use for irrigation?
Oof, this is a tough one. I am thinking it's either going to be surprisingly high or surprisingly low. Well, we have all these huge aquifers supplying areas with water, but I know that water regulations about how much people use their water aren't super widespread. At least in East Idaho, where I'm from, I remember a lot of the water wasn't metered. And in college, I remember learning about the tight water needs in the Palouse, which for listeners outside of Moscow is a mostly dry land farming area and beans, and was actually the lentil capital of America. I remember learning that the aquifer had been really depleted over time because of chronic overuse of water, and it couldn't replenish itself in time. So I'm going to say teens, like, you know, 19 or 18. How close am I?
I don't know if close is the appropriate term, but we're actually number two in the nation, just behind California, for the amount of water that we use for irrigation.
Okay, is this one of those lists where it's very clear we don't want to be that high?
I don't know if it's a don't want to be. I think it's a good awareness. And to talk us through what it means, we are going to talk to today Karen Humes, a professor in the Department of Earth and Spatial Sciences. And we're going to discuss how our water use for irrigation and water use for energy production are delicately balanced. And what might happen if they become unbalanced. So, are you ready to dive in?
Let's go.
Hi, Karen. Thank you so much for coming on The Vandal Theory today. How are you doing?
Good. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. Can you introduce yourself for everyone while we're here?
Surely. My name is Dr. Karen Humes, and I'm a professor in the Earth and Spatial Sciences Department here at the University of Idaho. My educational background is in hydrology and soils and the use of something called remote sensing, which is all about using satellite and aircraft and now, of course, drone imagery to learn things about the Earth from above, from space, or a little lower now down in the atmosphere. And early in my career, I was always interested in the interactions of energy and water at the sort of plant scale, or the scale of one field or one patch of desert or forest. But more recently, in the last several years, I've been getting interested in this topic of energy and water use at the sort of macro scale, at the scale of the whole southern half of our state, for example. So this coupling of energy and water is really important, both physically and societally. And I've been enjoying working on this topic for just the last several years, along with my PhD student, Emily Thompson.
So you're getting into my first question, which is what kind of question were you trying to tackle in your most recent research?
Yeah, so this question about the interconnectedness of food production and water and energy is a really big topic in the general scientific community right now, and has been for about 6 or 7 years. But here in Idaho, we really experience it in a big way, because our use of water and our use of energy and our huge amount of food production, particularly in the irrigated systems in southern Idaho, are really, really connected. And the reason we care about energy and water being connected is that when two big basic needs like that, water and energy, when they're really tightly coupled, that means that they're dependent on one another. And it means that if you use more of one, like water, you're probably going to use more of one, like energy. Or if you have less water, you might be able to generate less electricity when you're dependent on hydropower. So the fact that these are so coupled leads to some vulnerabilities for us. And that's why we wanted to study this interaction of food production, water, and energy.
So I just want to make sure we've drawn these lines really clearly. So here in Idaho, of course, we have a lot of hydropower. We need water to make energy. But then in irrigation, one, we need water for irrigation, but we also need energy to move the water.
That's correct. And the reason that it's such a big deal here in Idaho is that I think perhaps a lot of Idaho residents don't quite grasp. I know even I didn't. Even I'm a hydrologist and I didn't really quite grasp until 6 or 7 years ago just what a huge volume of water we use here in Idaho for food production. We're really fortunate to have both surface water resources from our mountain snowpack as well as great groundwater resources and the huge Eastern Snake Plain aquifer down in southeastern Idaho and aquifers in southwest Idaho as well. But we withdraw so much water. We're actually tops in the country in a number of ways. We're the number three state in terms of just how much water we withdraw from either groundwater or surface water resources for any use whatsoever. And then when you look at what we use all that water for, about 97% of it is for agricultural production. About 11% is used for aquaculture, which is an important business in our state, industry in our state. But then a full 86% of it is used for irrigation. So in our project, we kind of focused on irrigation because in terms of looking at Idaho being tops in the country, we're number three for total water withdrawals behind only very populous states like California and Texas. But we're number two for how much water we withdraw each year to be used specifically for irrigation behind only California. So we're second to California in terms of the volume of water used for irrigation. And when we do withdraw water for irrigation, that involves the use of a lot of energy, so much so that what we are number one in the country for is that we are first in the country for how much of our electrical power goes to just moving water around. And the big energy costs for moving water around comes from, we do it, even the domestic water we use in our homes and businesses, that costs some energy as well. But because the volume of water that we use for irrigation is so huge, we use a lot of energy to put that irrigation water where it needs to be. Some of it, about a third of it, we have to pump out of the ground. That is expensive energy-wise. But then all of it, the irrigation water that either comes from streams, diversion from streams, or the water that's pumped from the ground, we have the additional energy use of having to distribute it to the crops. And it's not something we think about very much, but if you're driving along and you see a highway and you see one of those large center pivot irrigation systems, you should think about energy use because it takes a lot of energy to pressurize the water to shoot it out to those very long arms on those center pivot devices. So we're really tops in the country for how much of our energy we use to distribute water. And that's all because of the huge volume of water that we use for irrigating our crops. It's about 86% of our total water use, as I mentioned.
That's crazy. That is not something that I would have, if you'd asked me to list who's the biggest water users, biggest energy users, I wouldn't have put Idaho anywhere close to the top. Okay, so we're using all of this water for hydropower, for irrigation, we're creating energy from water, we're using energy on the land. That seems like a very delicate little balance of, you know, what we're producing and what we need. What are some things that could unbalance that, and what does that look like?
Yeah, great question. One of the things that causes that balance to get a little out of whack and to make push come to shove is when we're in periods of drought. And that's been happening more recently, as we know, and it's predicted to happen more going forward. And so and we see the evidence of this already. You know, there have been water calls, as they're referred to in southern Idaho, where senior water rights users have had to ask junior water right users to curtail their use and such. In times of drought, we have more demand by the crops for this water. So everyone wants to pump more water to provide the crops with what they need. That also is going to then mean more energy. If we have to pump more water distributed out to the crops, that means more energy is used. But at the same time, during times of drought and low stream flow, we have a harder time generating that energy with our hydropower resources. So it really puts the squeeze in there because we need more water and we need more energy. But our biggest resource for generating energy, hydropower, then need to be curtailed. So it really squeezes us. It makes us vulnerable in these times of drought. There's kind of a famous example among those of us that study these water energy connections in India in 2012 during a drought time. Farmers were having to pump more water to water the crops sufficiently. Also another situation in which they're very much dependent on energy being generated by hydropower, by hydroelectric dams. The hydroelectric dams didn't have enough, wasn't enough water in the streams and reservoirs to have the hydroelectric dams generate the electricity that was needed. So three power grids that were connected to one another failed, and something like 1/9 of the world's population, 620 million people, were without power for several days as a result of that. And, you know, there have been kind of somewhat similar examples. Maybe 10 or 20 years ago, we might have thought, well, our power grid is more resilient than that. That won't happen here, right? But all the things we've heard about how we used to invest in things like power grid infrastructure a lot, but it's been tough making those investments in the last several decades, should give us pause to think about the fact that we're vulnerable. As long as we maintain this really tight connection between water and energy, we are vulnerable.
So right now, you guys are basically studying this whole little set of dominoes that are set up. What are you doing for your project? And why have you taken this on?
Yeah, so what we are trying to do is to better quantify how much water is used for irrigation and how that changes with dry years versus wet years. So we're looking at the last 20, 25 years of data on water use and energy use for irrigation in order to better understand how these periods of wet versus dry, these climatic changes or variability in the last 25 years or so, how has that translated into how much more water is required and how much more energy is required? And then we're putting that into something called a systems dynamics model that would help water users and water planners in the state. We have a couple of state entities that are responsible for planning for water use in the state to make sure that demand in the future is met, as well as entities that are responsible for making sure that the energy needs are met. So it's this system dynamics model is intended to be a tool for those kinds of water and energy planners so that we can see, well, if we turn this knob a little bit, if we change this situation a little bit, if we change that situation a little bit, what's that likely to do with this balance? How can we lessen our vulnerability, increase our resilience to this dependence between water and energy and climate? Because quite frankly, the climate drivers are what drive the additional water demand by plants, as well as the lower summer streamfall that is predicted. The predictions are that summer stream flows in all of the Northwest will be lower than they are now. They have been decreasing for a couple of decades, and that's going to continue to happen with climate change into the next 40 to 60 years. I probably should have elaborated that the reason that summer stream flow is going to be lower, of course, is because the change in climate really shifts our snowpack quite a lot, changes our snowpack quite a lot. And when you change snowpack, then you shift the timing and the magnitude, the amount of that melting snow runoff. So this shift in snowpack, less snow, more rain, gives us higher flows in the wintertime and early spring, and then lower flows in the summertime. And the problem is when you rely on that water for irrigation, and that summertime is the growing season, is when you're wanting to withdraw the most water for the irrigation, then that's when this push comes to shove with having enough water for the generation of hydropower as well. So we're trying to develop a tool which we can tweak the big knobs of what decisions farmers can make, what decisions we can make about energy sources, and how that can help us be less vulnerable, more resilient.
Specifically, who are the ones in Idaho who could end up using the model?
Right. So Idaho Department of Water Resources, to answer your question directly, is the state agency responsible for monitoring water use and managing water use. They're really very sophisticated. They are using a lot of science-based tools, some very sophisticated models and monitoring systems with satellite data and such to monitor the amount of water being used by crops. We also have a groundwater model that's used for decisions about groundwater, including recharge of our groundwater. So we're really fortunate to have a really sophisticated state agency in charge of those decisions. So we're hoping it'll be useful to them. And also the Idaho Water Resources Board is the entity that, it's a governor-appointed citizens board that sets policy with regard to water use, and then the Idaho Department of Water Resources implements those policies. And they're genuinely interested in science-based techniques. They've demonstrated that quite a bit. And then, of course, we have a host of agencies responsible for energy planning. The Public Utilities Commission requires our power providers like Idaho Power and Rocky Mountain Power down south have to be demonstrating that they have the energy resources in place to meet our energy demands in the future as well.
So let's talk about some of those knobs that within the model you guys can actually tweak or regulators could actually use to influence, you know, how close we are to that pinch point. What can they change about the system that will keep us from having any sort of water or energy crisis?
Absolutely. That's what we're about. So anything we can do to reduce water use will also reduce our demand for energy to apply that water. So that would be things such as we can make irrigation systems more water-friendly, more conservative of water. In Idaho, we have about 3.2 million acres that are irrigated, and about a third of that is still irrigated with flood irrigation, which uses more water than the sprinkler irrigation that we see in the center pivots or an even more water-friendly mode of irrigation that is for drip, but you can only use drip for certain kinds of crops that you're not taking tractors through the field with and that sort of thing. So we can conserve water in our irrigation management practices. Also, just a little bit, the types of crops that are planted. Some crops require more water than others. Here in Idaho, that tends to be a difference between, say, an alfalfa field that you water for a much longer period of time versus a crop that gets watered for a shorter period of time. So we can, farm producers can make some choices there to conserve water. Importantly, though, on the other side of the coin is how can we reduce our water dependence with our electricity generation? How can our electricity generation be less dependent on water? So that means a little less dependence on hydropower. And of course, we don't want to move back to fossil fuel. We don't want more dependence on gas and coal-fired power plants. Not only do those put carbon into the atmosphere, but those are also water-intensive ways to generate electricity too, because you have to use a lot of water to cool those kinds of plants. So hydropower, gas, and coal-fired power plants, they're all very water-intensive. So as we think about how to reduce this coupling, how to reduce this vulnerability, we should be thinking about energy systems, especially as we're making these energy transformations, energy transitions to less carbon-emitting energy sources. We should be thinking about the water footprint as well. So it's another endorsement, actually, for solar and wind power, because those are very light with regard to almost non-existent. Of course, there's some you need some water to manufacture those. Solar and wind, but with solar PV and wind energy, that's a zero water footprint on those. So we need to think about how to reduce our reliance on hydropower as well.
So do you have any next steps for this project?
Yes. One of the things that I'm working with Dr. Russ Qualls over in the Department of Biological and Chemical Engineering, I mentioned that in this current project, we are trying to evaluate some of the past couple of decades of data on crop water demand and how that's changed, how both crop water demand and energy use has changed with some of the climate variability we've seen in the last 20 to 25 years. But Dr. Qualls and I are trying to find some support to better quantify what we could expect into future decades. How much would the crop water demand change as the climate changes over the next 20 to 60 years? And then what would that translate into in terms of further energy demand?
Well, so we're getting towards the end here. Any last thoughts that you want to leave with our listeners?
Right. So I've talked mostly about the water and energy connections in large-scale irrigated agriculture, but it might be beneficial also for your listeners to think about the water and energy connections even in our daily lives. You know, I've talked about how it takes a lot of energy to distribute water to irrigated crops. It also takes a fair amount of energy to treat water. If we use surface water resources and the water needs to be treated before it can be used as drinking water, that uses energy. Whenever we pump groundwater out of the ground to have water to use for our homes and businesses, that uses a lot of energy too. So we should all be mindful of this connection between water and energy. I would love to see the day in which we teach all the school kids that when you lift a faucet to turn on some water, you're also using electricity. And when you switch on a light switch, we all know we're using energy and we need to conserve energy, but you're also using water when you use energy because we are so dependent on hydropower and the generation of electricity with hydropower. So it's not, although this footprint of the food production industry in Idaho is very large, we also need to think about it in our own daily choices and also the choices by communities about where and how to get additional drinking water resources. They all come at a bit of a cost energy-wise.
All right. Well, Karen, thank you so much for coming on today.
Great. Well, thank you for having me. It was fun. I always like to talk about this topic.
All right, Kyle, what did you think?
That was really helpful in that it connected a lot of dots that I probably wouldn't have connected on my own. I think it can be really easy to part and parcel things out when we think about these huge systems. But what Karen really shows is that you can't just think about food systems, energy, and water systems separately. They're very interconnected, and a change in one can have ripple effects in another. For example, about how hydropower, for instance, while being a relatively stable and low-cost form of energy, relies on us having enough water for everything else we need to have water for, on top of having enough water to turn rotors and rivers and supply energy. So I think this is really helpful to think about sustainability issues as part of an ecosystem where everything is pushing and pulling off each other. And this, to me, also helps prove the value of bringing in specialized researchers like Karen together to solve issues, and the value of bringing interdisciplinary approaches to these research issues, because they don't exist in a silo. There are lots of other things that are playing in.
Yeah, I find it continuously amazing how I feel like I have spent much of my adult life studying topics like this, water use, you know, environmental sciences type, you know, topics. I lived in California for a while where, you know, you get told all the time about protecting water and take your short showers and save your extra shower water to water your plants with. But nobody had really drawn the connection back to energy for me and the connection between water and energy. And so it's amazing to me, despite the fact that, you know, I've been in this field for a while, this was a connection that finally went, oh, right. And it, you know, always learning.
That's the fun part about working at U of I. You learn something new every day.
So true. All right, everyone. Well, thank you for listening to The Vandal Theory. You can visit our website, uidaho.edu/vandaltheory, if you want to learn more about our research. And you can email us at vandaltheory@uidaho.edu if you have questions or comments about what you're hearing. We're on most of the podcasting platforms out there, so please go and rate and review us, and of course, subscribe. All right, everyone. I'm Lee Cooper.
And I'm Kyle Fonensteel.
Thanks, everyone.